There's a lot going on in the world, and this is what we think you should know about on this day.
I don't trust Pakistan as far as I can throw them. That tells me we should be looking maybe for somebody else to mediate.
There's still a legion of professionals in the law enforcement environment who are refusing to follow politically motivated prosecutions.
Talk about hypocrisy. We're going to be looking at what the CIA did and is still doing around the world with an interview with a former CIA special agent, John Kariakou. This is the Sanchez Effect. What do you say we do this? Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez, and I want to thank you for being among the millions and millions watching us daily from all over the world, even though you're watching in many cases from places where Western elites don't want you to be watching, but you find a way to see it anyway. All right, let's get started. And we're going to start with Mr. Trump in China. Let me say this. Never before, since this very first meeting among the two superpowers where Mr. Nixon sat down with Mr. Mao, has China been so strong. And the U.S., let's just say less strong. I don't even want to say weak. And why has this happened? The Iran war, that's why it's happened. Clearly. Let me take you through this. Ready? So here's what this new strong China stands for. First, they're saying we're no longer going to comply with your sanctions. In fact, we will henceforth ignore your sanctions. In essence, the Chinese are saying we are not going to be supplicants to the West anymore. As for these tech bros that went along with Mr. Trump that you may see in some of these videos, because he's bringing them over there with them, they have lost what they once had, which was a vaulted position in China, right? Xi is going to allow them into the Chinese market. He's not going to stop them from going into their market, but they're going to do it from now on China's terms, he says. And as for them having a say in China's supply chain itself, no more. China is basically saying, look, when we found customers all over the world, new customers, since you forced us out. So now, if you want back in, it'll be on our terms and you can take it or leave it. Let's talk about tariffs. China is suggesting that if Mr. Trump asks respectfully, it will negotiate to reduce China's tariffs it placed on the United States. My God, it's like everything is an upside down game here, right? China retaliated, you might recall, against Trump's tariffs back when. The Chinese placed a 20% tariff on U.S. crude oil, for example. 25% tariff on LNG, liquefied natural gas. 13% tariff on soybeans. And up to 77% on beef from U.S. farmers and ranchers. Ouch, right? That hurts. So there's one other thing we got to talk about, Iran, because I said this yesterday in my conversation with Professor Pape. It seems like Iran is like the cement that is solidifying this new China power that we're seeing unveiled in the last 3 months or so. The U.S. is asking China to side with it over Iran. And China's saying, what, are you kidding? It's like they find that request almost laughable. Listen to how Professor Robert Pape and I discussed this yesterday here on the Sanchez Effect. Well, you know where Donald Trump, I think, is going to be seen, not as a loser, but as someone who is diminished? Big countries like China, even Russia.
And
countries who are looking at this, South Korea, Japan, who say, wait a minute, you couldn't protect those guys? How the hell are you going to protect us? Here's Trump arriving. Here's Trump arriving in China today. Let's look at the video of this, and you'll see him. Great fanfare. You know, the Chinese are very respectful people. They've got the bands. They want to show him like they really appreciate the fact that he's come there. They're doing everything right. But behind the scenes, these guys are looking at this guy as, you know what, we got him right where we want him. He is weakened right now, and we ain't going to give him anything. That's what I'm thinking, but you're smarter than
you
I am.
You got it exactly, Rick. I mean, this is a little bit like the snake that's looking you in the eye to charm you, and then it strikes. So this is, and it's not unique to like Chinese culture or something. Hmm. This is the way great power politics is played. And by the way, that's how Donald Trump explained it on the campaign trail. He said, look, I'm going to have to go up against the toughest, most ruthless, most clever, most cunning people in the world here. And well, now he is. The difference is he's coming in with this strategic defeat now that has happened to him. It's not exactly the war is over. That's not it at all. But at the moment, we've been in this now almost 3 months, right? Think about this. And we've got nothing really to show for it on our side. And Iran has a lot on their side. And everybody's seeing that.
That's the truth. Look, the picture that seems to be coming out of all this new era in U.S.-China relations is that China was already strong. But Mr. Trump's pugnacious policies, his actions in Iran have, unfortunately for U.S. foreign policy, made China stronger, right? So here's a question. Do Western elites recognize this? No. Unfortunately, they're too uninformed, dare I say, stupid to understand this. Many in America, especially the wealthy neocons, they when you listen to them talk, you think they're still living in like the 1950s or something. To them, this is how they see the world. Everybody out there except the United States is weak and poor and uncivilized, except for maybe Europe and Israel. And to those countries, the rules don't matter. See, to them, China is like a peasant labor country. Russia is some poor socialist country with nothing but a couple of big bombs and some oil, right? India is a backward, overpopulated slum. The Middle East is nothing but, you know, and Central Asia, they're like fanatical savages in those places. You want me to give you, you want to see an example? You want to see the, how do I say this? I know. The personification of what I'm talking about, he is.
If the mediator is allowing reconnaissance aircraft of Iran to be parked in Pakistani air bases, do you think that's consistent with being a fair mediator?
I wouldn't want to get in the middle of these negotiations. Yeah. I want
well,
maximum
I do.
Efficacy
I
for
want to
people.
Get in the middle of these negotiations. I don't trust Pakistan as far as I can throw them. If they actually do have Iranian aircraft parked in Pakistan bases to protect Iranian military assets, that tells me we should be looking maybe for somebody else to mediate.
Does he have any idea how stupid he sounds when you consider the double standard? Because, yeah, he's criticizing Pakistan because it may have some relationship with Iran while negotiating with both sides. But look at what he's ignoring. The United States has been negotiating with Russia while literally bombing Russia, using Ukraine as a proxy. Everybody knows that. Does he not know that? Does he just think the United States and Europe and others can do whatever they want, but the rest of these you-know-what countries just have to abide by his rules? I'll give you another example. Here's an even better one. As far as negotiators perhaps not being even-handed go, what do you say about Jared Kushner? What do you tell me about Stephen Witkoff? Even Vice President Vance, they're reporting to Israel while they're negotiating. Literally reporting, yeah, reporting to Israel, just like you report to your boss. Or in my case, I report to my wife. How do we know this? Netanyahu is literally bragging about it. Here he is.
My name is Ghana J.D. Vance.
Yesterday, I spoke with Vice President J.D. Vance. He called me from his plane on his way back from Islamabad. He reported to me in detail, as members of this administration do every day, on the development in the negotiations. The understanding actually was that they would cease firing and Iran would immediately open the strait. They did not do so. The Americans could not accept this.
But he said, I don't know if you heard it there, they call me every day. They report to me after they meet with the negotiators from Iran in Pakistan. Can it be any clearer? Whose side are they on, right? So how can Lindsey Graham and others not see something like this? And where, by the way, where's the pushback? Why do I, who can obviously see this, find him laughable? By the way, people all over the world find him laughable. But where are the other reports on this? Shouldn't the BBC be saying, what the hell is Lindsey Graham talking about? How about the New York Times? How about CNN? How about Le Monde? How about Der Spiegel? I mean, just, if nothing else, do a critical analysis of the comment. They don't. They just put it on the air as if it's gospel, right? Look, if the U.S. is in a hole right now, it's a hole of its own making from people who talk like Lindsey Graham. It's just so narcissistic. It's so grandiose. And you know what it is most of all? It's about not being self-aware. That is so missing. Unfortunately, it's rooted in history. It comes from a time when the United States used the CIA, and the CIA would literally go all over the world doing willy-nilly whatever the hell it wanted to do to whomever it wanted to do it to. I told you about Lindsey Graham yesterday, and I told you about Robert Kagan and his wife, Victoria Nuland, as well, right? These are neocons to the nth degree. Here they are. I got a picture of them. Look at these two. This is Washington's power couple. Not a single war, not a single coup that these two haven't supported, or worse, actually caused with unethical, clandestine, back-channel deals. And they're still doing it. And they do it out in the open, and then they're interviewed on CNN like they're geniuses. Remember I told you a few shows back, you guys killed me for it. I got a bunch of comments on Twitter after I put this out. How one of the reasons that I was fired, right, summarily fired and embarrassed and humiliated when I was at CNN was because I began wanting to do stories about the CIA's intervention around the world, especially in Latin America, because that's where I come from. And those are the stories my dad told me. The big guys, the bosses at CNN literally yelled at me as if I was crazy for wanting to report something like that, even though it's true. Colombia, Dominican Republic, Cuba, Chile, Bolivia, Venezuela, Ecuador, El Salvador, Nicaragua. I mean, we should know about the assassinations, the coups, the horrible things that we did, that CIA did to people in those countries, so that we can simply avoid making mistakes in the future, like we all do. We can all learn. I found this video. I want to show it to you. It's a historical video from the 1960s. It's a guy who used to be my hero, John Chancellor. He's a big anchor in the United States at NBC. He's interviewing a guy named Alan Dulles. Big name in American history when it comes to intel. This guy, Dulles, remember the name, Dulles. He was the head of the CIA. He was, by the way, a horrible person. But here he is being asked by Chancellor about what the CIA does.
There are times when the United States government feels that the developments in another government, such as in the Vietnam situation, is of a nature to imperil the safety and the security and the peace of the world, and ask the Central Intelligence Agency to be its agent in that particular situation.
Mr. Dulles, I know you've heard this many times, but there are people who say that we, with regard to the CIA, are waging a secret war with an invisible government.
We are obviously engaged in many facets of what is generally called the Cold War, which the communist policy has forced upon us. No use denying that. That's a fact of life. But may I say this, and I do it with all solemnity. At no time has the CIA engaged in any political activity or any intelligence activity that was not approved at the highest level.
Not approved at the highest levels. That, my friends, is a bold-faced lie. The CIA was not getting approval at the highest levels. It was, in fact, acting at the very time that he was saying that as a rogue organization, and it was proven. I'll show you somebody. This is Frank Church, a really decent man who spearheaded the Church Committee back in 1975 in the United States. And it found with tons of evidence and testimony that the CIA was involved in sabotage, assassinations, fomented coups, and much of it without approval from anybody other than itself. In fact, there's no better example of CIA self-dealing than what it did in Guatemala, where there was a company called the United Fruit Company. It owned 70% of the land in Guatemala. Think about that for a minute. A company in the United States owned 70% of a foreign country's land. So when this guy here, Jacobo Arbenz, tried to change that, he was elected president of Guatemala. He wanted to institute land reforms to give some pieces of land back to the people of Guatemala. The CIA went in and had this guy removed to protect the United Fruit Company. Remember the name. Arbenz was ousted. A CIA puppet government was installed. A civil war then broke out, killed 200,000 people. And by the way, who do you think had a controlling interest? You're not going to believe this. Who do you think had a controlling interest in the United Fruit Company? I'll show them to you. Remember I said, remember the name Dulles? That's John Foster Dulles. Yes, Alan Dulles's brother. So think about this for just a minute. The director of the CIA intervened to change a government of Guatemala that ended up killing 200,000 people, and in the process, so that he could help his brother's company profit from it. Yeah. That's the kind of story CNN said you're not allowed to do, Mr. Sanchez. You're fired. You're out of here. There's another thing you should know about this story, because it's fascinating. So President John F. Kennedy hated the Dulles brothers. Kennedy had crazy ideas, right? Like, he wanted to have good relations with Russia. Ooh, the Dulleses hated that idea. Kennedy wanted to make peace with Cuba. Crazy, right? He wanted to end the war in Vietnam, which was a disaster. Crazy, right? And he also wanted to rein in the CIA. He wanted to defang them, right? And his CIA director at the time was Alan Dulles. Alan Dulles hated him for that, hated Kennedy. So Kennedy fired Alan Dulles. You're out of here. Get out, right? Because this guy was a nut. He wanted to go around the world starting wars and killing people. So not long after Kennedy fires Dulles, this happens.
Here is a bulletin from CBS News. In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
Then it was back to the soap opera, but not for long.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time. 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago.
That's one of the most iconic moments in American history. That, my friends, is Walter Cronkite. Kennedy's killed. But the story's not over. This gets even better. Not long after Kennedy is killed, not long after this happens, the Warren Commission is established. And you're not going to believe who gets appointed to the Warren Commission. He's back. There he is. There's Alan Dulles. See the guy in the bow tie over the way over there on the right? See the guy on the bow tie? See him right there? Yep, that's the guy who hated Kennedy with a passion. The guy who ran the CIA that was described as rogue. The guy Kennedy fired was now going to determine how Kennedy was killed. How convenient. Look at him. Look at them all there. And look at the picture of the dead president on the wall behind them, seemingly almost looking down at them as if to say, what the hell did you guys do? What do you think? It's a hell of a story. That's a story I was never allowed to tell when I worked at CNN. And soon after that, I was fired for even wanting to do it. Joining us now is somebody who spent years working in the CIA and was jailed for, in fact, telling its truths. John Kariakou is one of the most ethical, one of the most uncompromised human beings I've ever known. I've worked with him. I call him a friend. He has a show that runs here, as a matter of fact, Deep State. Really good show. And he's good enough to join us now. John, how good to see you, my friend.
Oh, it's so good to see you, Rick. Thanks so much for the invitation.
You are like the cat's meow recently. I've seen you everywhere. It's like I can't turn on my TV and put it on YouTube or whatever without seeing someone wanting to talk to you. This must be pretty cool for you, and very deserved, by the way, especially compared to a guy who was in jail not long ago.
Yeah, I said something to a friend of mine the other day. I said, 11 short years ago, I was in a cage in Western Pennsylvania and, you know, deemed to be unfit to live among civilized society. And now here I am. Things have changed utterly, completely, especially in the last 10 weeks. Things have really taken off. And I'll tell you one thing that I'm very proud of, Rick, is I've never wavered in my in my determination to tell the truth. And it's finally, you know, people finally understand that I was the one telling the truth about the CIA, about the CIA's torture program, about secret prisons, and about illegal renditions. My detractors are largely dead or retired, and the ones who are alive have been discredited. And so I will take that victory.
Yeah, and we should probably start there, just so people know, you know, I know, a lot of people know this story because you've told it to Tucker and you've told it all over the place. You were essentially put in jail for telling the truth about something very wrong that our country was doing at the time, which was your duty. You were saying that we were torturing people and that it was illegal. That was essentially what you did wrong, right?
That was it. Yes, that was it.
And this is the guy who put you in jail, essentially, in many ways, a guy named John Brennan. Here he is. We've got John Brennan now talking about something which kind of you're going to find ironic. Let's play it.
There's still a legion of professionals in the law enforcement environment, the Department of Justice, as well as the CIA and other places, the ones who are refusing to follow politically motivated prosecutions, those who are refusing to support any type of political activities on the part of the Trump administration that are inconsistent with the authorities, the responsibilities of the intelligence community, law enforcement community, and Department of Justice.
How ironic that he's making the argument almost on your behalf when he's the guy, according to the story that I've heard you tell me and others, was responsible for your undoing.
Yeah, it was such a rich comment. He has such nerve to profess to be the victim here. He was the one who weaponized government against dissidents, against people, truth tellers, whistleblowers, people who were calling out the crimes committed by the CIA. He was the one who was single-handedly responsible for putting me in prison. So I don't want to hear his complaints about how he's being wronged. The birds have come home to roost, and now it's his turn.
That's good. That's rich. You're absolutely right. Well, what did you think? You know, I said some things in my monologue that I've always felt, maybe because I grew up in Latin America, I saw the things that we did in places. I use Guatemala as one of the worst examples, but I could have used Chile, as you know, as well, or Santo Domingo or a lot of other places. You were there. I mean, you weren't there in the 50s when our Baines and all that happened, but you know the history of the CIA. Has it changed, or do we still do that kind of stuff?
Oh, no, they still do that kind of stuff every day. Rick, I was so glad to see that you spoke about the United Fruit Company, because when I talk about the United Fruit Company, people's eyes glaze over. Yeah. They don't know what I'm talking about. Yeah. You said correctly that John Foster Dulles was an integral, major part of the United Fruit Company. When he was the Secretary of State under President Dwight D. Eisenhower, I'll go one farther. John Foster Dulles, the Secretary of State, Alan Dulles, the CIA director, and President Eisenhower's secretary's brother were all on the board of directors of the United Fruit Company. They weren't just investors. They were on the board of directors of the United Fruit Company when Art Benz was overthrown and was replaced with a military junta. Nobody was ever prosecuted for such an illegal act. That was in the 50s. And the CIA continued to do things like this all over the world, all the way up until today.
But the CIA should be there, and it's an important organization, and it's an admirable organization that should be there to protect me and my granddaughter and my children and all Americans from having any harm come to them. But it shouldn't be there to sell American commodities like oil or sugar in the case of Latin America.
Rick, when I was a brand new analyst in 1990, My boss instructed me to give a briefing. I said, great, because I would get credit for every briefing I would do. And then at the end of the month, I would send in a monthly report saying, these are the people I briefed, these are the articles that I wrote, et cetera, et cetera. I said, sure, who's the briefing for? He said, Exxon. I said, Exxon? No, nobody at Exxon has a security clearance. I can't give a classified briefing to Exxon. And he said, well, this is just something that we do for our corporate partners. And I said, listen, I'm brand new and all, and I don't really know the day-to-day life here, but I know that I cannot give a classified briefing to somebody who doesn't have a security clearance. I'm not talking to Exxon. And I refused. But that's normal daily life.
So bring that to today, because, you know, there's an argument, as you well know, that what we're doing in Iran has everything to do with commodities and nothing to do with nuclear power or regime change or any of this other stuff that they're talking about. It originally was all about oil and hydrocarbons, which Iran happens to have. And by the way, the two countries that we've hit, Venezuela and Iran, oh boy, what a coincidence, right? And these are the kinds of things that are often done by the so-called intel community, the people who are making this happen and have Mr. Trump's ear. How much of that is true?
Oh, it's absolutely true. I went into Kuwait City, Rick, on the 17th of February, 1991, with the Marines on Liberation Day. And we reopened the American embassy. And I remember a couple of days later having a debate with one of the embassy employees who happened to be a Palestinian. He said, you only liberated this country for the oil. And I was young and idealistic. I said, that's not true. We liberated Kuwait because it was the right thing to do. And he said to me, do you really believe that the U.S. military would have come here to liberate this country if it was known for its gravel rather than for its oil? And I couldn't respond because he was right. If Kuwait had had gravel, if Iran has gravel instead of oil and natural gas, would we care at all?
Yeah.
Of course not. We would treat Iran like we treat, you know, Rwanda or Bolivia, where we just don't really have any national interests. It's all about the oil. It's all about the commodities and the resources. And it always has been. That's why we overthrew the Iranian government in 1953.
Yeah.
It was all about the oil.
Yeah, with Mujahideen. How about Afghanistan? Because not a lot of oil, but they do have another commodity that's quite interesting.
Yes.
And I guess that you find it in what? Poppy seeds, right?
A lot of it's in poppy seeds, that's for sure. But they have trillions and trillions of dollars worth of rare earth metals.
Yeah.
And the United States right now is almost wholly dependent on China for our rare earth metals. The only other countries that really have them in vast quantities are Afghanistan and the Democratic Republic of Congo, neither one of which have, you know, easy access. And so we're stuck. But you're right. On the one hand, it's all about the poppy bulbs.
Yeah.
And
the heroin, right? Sure, I mean, literally, heroin production went up when the United States was there. And I think I heard you say that you can prove it went down afterward.
It down to almost zero. Listen, in 2000, the last year, the last full year of Taliban rule, Afghanistan produced zero heroin poppy, zero. By the time the United States took over, Afghanistan was responsible for producing 93% of the world's heroin. And almost all of that heroin went to Russia and Iran. And the U.S., of course, not only did nothing to stop it, the U.S. encouraged the cultivation of heroin poppy.
Could we, did you see it when you were on assignment there, right? At some point.
Oh yes, many times. Yes. You would fly into Lashkar Gah, the capital of Helmand province, and as far as your eye could see, it was nothing but an ocean of poppy.
But why would the farmers do this? Did the farmers in Afghanistan not have some kind of ethical motivation to not grow something which addicts people and kills people?
I got multiple responses to that question. That was a question that I asked quite frequently. Why don't you grow things with two growing seasons, like tomatoes or onions or pomegranates, instead of poppy? And excuse me, Some of the responses were that the Americans had told them they could grow all the poppy they wanted so long as they told the Americans where the Arabs were hiding. I believe that completely. I'm sure that that was true. On the other hand, some told me that a representative of the Afghan government came with sacks of poppy seeds and said, you will grow these. And if you don't, you're going to get a bullet in your head. And that's why they were grown.
You know, something happened recently not far from Afghanistan. When I was doing the news on NBC and CNN, the biggest story of our time was the invasion of Afghanistan and our relationship with Pakistan. The president at the time, Musharraf, thank you, who had gotten millions and millions of dollars from our government, by the way, was very much in charge of all that. There's some news today, which I thought you would find interesting. I don't know if you've seen this yet. Put up this Reuters report, Gene, if we got it. You got this Reuters report? The U.S. is closing its Peshawar consulate and putting it pretty much to bed, which is really fascinating. I'm not sure what this says. The U.S. has always been so much in control, and I know you and other CIA agents probably had a lot to do with that. Why would the United States be walking away from that in Pakistan, as far as you think?
There are two answers that come to mind, one more plausible than the other. One is that it's so dangerous in Peshawar that it just doesn't make any sense to remain open. I don't believe that's the case at all. Mm. I think that the reason why the Peshawar consulate is closing is just like we saw in the very late 1980s into the 1990s, the administration has concluded that we just don't have any national interests there. Hmm. Now, of course, that's not true. Of course, we have national interests in Peshawar. Safety and security, right? It's right at the head of the Khyber Pass. Yeah. That's how you get from Afghanistan to Pakistan is through Peshawar. But, you know, one of the things that the American government likes to do, and we saw this at the very end of the Reagan administration, the beginning of the George H.W. Bush administration through Bill Clinton, until 2001, was just to pretend that everything's fine. Yeah. And we don't have any national interest there. We're just going to walk away.
You were in Bush. You started in 1990, and correct me if I'm wrong, you were there all the way until the mid-2000s?
Yes.
Bush, Clinton, Bush, a little bit of Obama. You were somehow involved?
Yeah, I went to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee under Obama.
Mm-hmm. I've heard you tell stories, which I have found just so fascinating, of how presidents in the United States are turned as soon as they get into office and reinstitutionalized as, I guess, neocons? Is that the right word?
They may have come in
thinking of peace and all this stuff, and immediately they're there to be another Lindsey Graham, so to speak, or John McCain, right? And you tell a story about how they did that to Obama, right?
Sure. They love when an incoming president is inexperienced. Barack Obama was a senator for 4 years. That's it. That's all. That was the full extent of his experience.
Yeah.
He had no background in intelligence, in defense, in foreign affairs, nothing. And they love that because they know they can shape that new president. And as I've said in previous interviews, when a new president comes in and he is shown his first blue border report or black border report, classified six levels above top secret, and they say, Mr. President-elect, we want to show you the cool things we're doing all around the world. They know they have him. They've recruited him. They've brought him in as one of the gang, one of the guys, and they've got him. That's what they did with Barack Obama.
And I don't know if you saw this, but I'll share something with you that I've been thinking about a lot lately. I recently had a conversation with a guy named Lukashenko. He's the president of Belarus. I'm sure you know him. I went there and spent some time with him, and I asked him, I said, you know, you're a dictator. That's what everybody says about you because you've been in office for 30 years and there's been nobody else. So are you a dictator? And he made me think about something. whether a country is a dictatorship or not has less to do with the guy in office and more to do with the system. Because what he said and what you've and what I've learned from you is that, yes, in the United States, we elect a new president every 4 years. But, John, based on what you report and based on what happens, our system doesn't change. It's the same damn system for more than 30 years. So where is really the dictatorship? And can you say you don't have a dictatorship just because you have an election? I'm not sure.
Well, I've said many times in interviews that the deep state is real. You don't have to call it the deep state. You can call it the federal bureaucracy.
Yeah.
You can call it the state, but it's real. You have presidents that come and go, Rick, every 4 years, every 8 years, they cycle in and out. But the leadership, the senior executive leadership at the CIA, at the FBI, at NSA, at DOD, they're there for 25, 30, 35 years. There's no changing them. And if they don't like what a president wants them to do, they just don't do it because they know in a few years that president's going to be gone.
Interesting.
And they're still going to be there.
And how does that mesh with, here's what I don't understand. In the United States, we have three forces that have nothing to do with the people of the United States, but are more powerful than the people of the United States. One of them is the donor class, which is vast, huge, and they're all multimillionaires and billionaires. The second is the military-industrial complex, as we've come to know it, and these are the people who make trillions of dollars off of constant wars that we fight but don't really need to fight. And the third is this tiny little country in the Middle East called Israel. And those are the three entities, as far as I see, that have the most sway over any of these people, from Obama through Clinton to Mr. Trump. How does this, the intel community tie into those three bodies, if at all?
Oh, yeah. The intelligence community is absolutely integral, absolutely 100% integral. You know, one of the things we haven't raised is the role of the military in intelligence. And I would go so far as to say, and this may not be the most popular position, but I would go so far as to say that the reason why we rarely have generals heading the intelligence services, especially CIA and DNI, is generals rose up through the ranks by saying, yes, sir. And what you need in a perfect world is somebody who has the wherewithal to stand up to a president and say, Mr. President, let me tell you why that's a terrible idea. But in fact, it goes far beyond that, to the point where these CIA directors or national intelligence directors become more powerful than a president.
Yeah.
And they say, sure, Mr. President, we'll take care of that policy right away. And then they laugh behind his back. Because as I said a moment ago, they know he's going to cycle out. People are going to forget all about him. We'll just wait for the next guy, and we'll mold him into what we want.
And how much do those guys in intel, the John Brennans of the world, just continue to make money, sometimes ungodly amounts of money, for the rest of their lives through the donor class and organizations and the media who then take care of them and pay their way for forever for them to spout this stuff, right?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because that's very important, something most people don't know. Before the 9/11 attacks, Rick, the highest concentration of millionaires per capita in the United States was in Silicon Valley in Northern California. No surprise there.
Yeah.
Post 9/11, the highest concentration of millionaires in the United States is in Washington, D.C.
Potomac, yeah. Yeah.
Potomac, everybody catches what they call Potomac fever, and you lobby Congress and you get these giant no-bid contracts and everybody gets rich. Well, that's exactly where former CIA directors go. They go on to the boards of directors of these companies. The CIA has this thing called InQtel. They got a congressional waiver in 2001 to allow them to invest, get this, for the CIA to invest in tech startups. The first investment that they made was $1.5 million to Palantir. Palantir is now a multi-billion dollar concern.
Yeah.
And who is the biggest shareholder? It's the CIA.
Yeah.
Now, before 9/11, of course, that would have been illegal. Now it's just the norm. The CIA has its fingers everywhere.
So let me get this right. The corporations, the donor class, the big companies, be they in tech or in defense, get their screws, so to speak, into the CIA director while he's on the job, promising him the future when he retires.
Yep.
So he knows he's got to kind of push what they want. In the meantime, this is the guy who's meeting with the President of the United States every day to give him intelligence briefings. Wouldn't you think then that those intelligence briefings are going to be the things that he knows will please his future employers? Did I get that right?
Absolutely right. Let's talk about our friend John Brennan for a second. John Brennan was a nobody. He was a 30-year CIA veteran making $100,000, $150,000 a year.
Uh-huh.
No big deal. So on his latest financial disclosure form, he claims stock options of between $5 and $25 million. How can somebody making $150,000 a year be worth $25 million in defense stock?
Yeah.
But that's the system we've given ourselves.
That's crazy. That's absolutely insane. I'm wondering, there's a lot of talk these days, and you just mentioned Palantir. So let me ask you this question. These data centers that we're hearing so much about, that are about to pop up all over the United States, there's a real argument being made that these things are being created, and they're monstrous, apparently. They're being created
gigantic
to not just to spy on the world and most of all Americans, that every single thing we touch, every piece of technology, every phone conversation, every mobile device, everything we touch, AirPods, everything. Me playing golf, having GPS on the golf course, they'll know where we are. They'll know what we're saying. They can tune into us. They can literally, it's going to be espionage to a degree that we've never seen before. This is what some people are saying. I'm not, but is it valid?
I did a podcast a couple of weeks ago where I walked around Arlington National Cemetery with a podcaster, and we stopped at the grave of every CIA officer killed in the line of duty.
Uh-huh.
And I gave a little 2-minute, this is who this person was. The video came out about a week and a half ago, and I watched it, and I said to a friend of mine in the same room with me, I said, "Oh, my posture's terrible in this video. What's wrong with me? I'm getting old. I'm kind of hunched over now. My posture's terrible." Within minutes, on Facebook, on Instagram, and on X, every single advertisement, literally every single advertisement, was for a posture straightener. And what are we supposed to conclude from that?
They're listening to you.
Constantly.
So, yes, there's no question we should be concerned about this. And unfortunately, Congress is not going to rein them in because Congress is somewhat owned by these same companies.
I'm glad you said that. Yes, that is 100% true. Congress is supposed to be the oversight authority. And they're not overseers. They're cheerleaders. They do just as they're told. You know, the days of the Frank Church Committee and the Otis Pike Committee in the House are long gone. They're all dead. All those giants who sat on that committee, Howard Baker, Barry Goldwater, Sam Ervin, Frank Church, George McGovern, they're all gone. And we have these midgets now in their place acting as, Lindsey Graham overseeing the intelligence community.
Yeah.
Good grief. He can't even oversee his own social life.
Let me share with you something else that bothers me since you and I are having this conversation like old friends. One of the things that bothers me is that I see the media putting a lot of attention on the Epstein case, but they're putting the attention on the wrong thing. They're constantly harping on the people who may have had sex or done terrible things unethical things that they probably shouldn't have done. And obviously it's wrong. And I have a daughter and I have a granddaughter and a wife and a mom. So like any man, I'm insulted by some of these things that happen. But they pay so much attention on the individuals who went to Epstein's Island or whatever and then were secretly recorded and now we know what they did. But they're paying very little attention to who put the camera there, who created this whole thing. Why did this happen? Why did some guy who nobody knows how he even became rich, how was he able to create this entrapment island that got all these famous people there so that they can take their picture and have them have sex, show them having sex with young girls and have something on them? My guess, it's Israel. It can't be anything.
It has to be.
Right?
Listen, just what we learned about Ehud Barak's apartment in Jeffrey Epstein's townhouse in Manhattan, where an Israeli tech team flew to New York from Tel Aviv to wire the whole place for security with security cameras, et cetera, et cetera. When we're talking about the island house, even the bathrooms, Rick, were wired for sound
right.
and for video. That didn't happen by itself.
Epstein didn't do that by himself, knew. Right? Epstein didn't do that by himself. Nobody, just no way.
No way.
It's like
no way. It has to be the Israelis.
Yeah, yeah. See, and when you but you turn on CNN or Fox or this one or that one, and all you hear is breaking news. Another person's name has come up in the Epstein files, and I'm thinking, okay, enough. I don't care about the persons in the Epstein files. I want to know how this was caused. What manifested this? What's behind all this? But they don't tell you that.
No.
They don't seem to be interested.
No, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. They don't tell you.
How much do you think this whole Iran debacle, because that's really what it's turned into. I'm not a military expert or a strategic expert, but I'm smart enough to know when something is working or not working, and this is not working for the Trump administration, fortunately or unfortunately. I mean, I would like to see an end to this thing. I don't want more people to die. I don't want my country to suffer anymore, and I certainly don't want Iranians to suffer anymore. But I'm looking at this and thinking, who talked this guy, this my president, into this? How did this? What are your thoughts on this? I mean, based on your experience.
Rick. Oh, yeah. Starting in the mid-1980s with Ronald Reagan, literally every Israeli prime minister who would come to the United States would go to the Oval Office and say, please bomb Iran, please bomb Iran, please bomb Iran. We're talking about Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, Donald Trump won,
yeah.
And Bill Clinton.
Donald Trump, too.
Joe Biden.
And Joe Biden.
Up until Donald Trump, too. Excuse me. And every single Israeli prime minister would have that same message, bomb Iran. Every president said no until Donald Trump. We know just from the last few weeks, Barack Obama said something. He said that toward the end of his presidency, Benjamin Netanyahu went to the White House and said, you've got to bomb Iran. And Obama said, I'm not going to do it. And Netanyahu said, if you don't bomb Iran, we're going to bomb Iran and we're going to use nuclear weapons. And Obama said, go ahead, be my guest. Go ahead, use the nuclear weapons, calling his bluff. And of course he didn't. But then Netanyahu came back and said to Donald Trump, if you don't bomb Iran, we're going to use nuclear weapons. And he said, oh, well, I don't want you to use nuclear weapons. I'll bomb Iran.
Mm.
Another thing that Netanyahu told us, and he used to say this all the time, was that the Iranian government was a house of cards. And as soon as the first missile was to be launched, the whole thing would collapse upon itself.
A 6,000-year-old civilization. Come on.
Yeah, exactly. Anybody who knew anything at all about Iran knew that that was ridiculous, that it was never true. But Donald Trump was suckered into it. And we know all this because the Israelis have bragged about it to their own media. All you have to see, all you have to read to get the inside scoop is the Jerusalem Post.
Yeah.
These guys leak to the Post and they lay everything out and then they laugh at us behind our backs.
How much of this did you see personally when you were a CIA agent? And let me ask the question more directly. How infiltrated into our government is the government of Israel?
Complete. It's complete. And I'll tell you where it's most complete is on Capitol Hill. You know, in government, especially at the CIA, the State Department, even DOD, there's pushback. But on Capitol Hill, it is complete and total. There are AIPAC lobbyists who are specifically assigned to each individual congressional office to the point where they just sit there on the couch all day, every day.
Do they get to attend intel meetings too? I mean, did you ever see them in meetings where you were discussing U.S. policy?
Not in classified meetings, but in policy meetings, yes, of course. Yes.
So why weren't the Chinese and the Russians allowed in then? And why weren't the French allowed in? And So they're the only ones allowed in those policy meetings.
The only ones. Rick, can you imagine? I was on Capitol Hill recently, and outside of Senator Tom Cotton's office, the chairman of the Intelligence Committee from Arkansas,
real character.
Outside of Lindsey Graham's office, outside of Representative Ralph Fine's office, there are Israeli flags. They have the Israeli flag on display at the entrance to their offices. Can you imagine if somebody had displayed the Russian flag or the Chinese flag or the Egyptian flag or the Greek flag? We would be called traitors. But it's perfectly okay to fly the Israeli flag at your congressional office. We're supposed to just accept that.
Is Israel spying on the United States? Does Israel spy on
absolutely, the United States? Absolutely, 100% yes. 1,000% yes, of course they are.
But they're our friends.
Yeah, right. They're our friends. One thing about the Israelis, and I learned this, you know, in 1990, we give the Israelis 99% of what we have, whether it's, you know, defense equipment or technology or whatever it is. They want 100%. We don't give them 100%. We give them 99%. We don't give anybody 100%. And so they steal the remaining 1%. They have spies spread out all over America.
Still not enough. It's like some friends I have. quickly, Ukraine. What has been, as far as you know, I know this kind of came after you had left, but I'm sure you still have some pretty good knowledge of what is the intel role in a place like Ukraine? Maybe a little less now, but more so during the Biden administration. Because we hear stories in Russia about MI6 and Mossad and CIA and how everything that happens in Russia, whenever you hear of a bridge being blown up or a house being hit with drones or any of these things, a general being assassinated, that it's not being done by Ukrainians. Sure, it may be Ukrainian hand, but it was all planned and the guidance and everything was done with intel from the United States or Israel or the British. Is that true? And can you take us through that?
Oh, yeah, that's true. There are two primary issues here. One is targeting and the other is training. So the Ukrainians on their own wouldn't have lasted a week. They don't have the wherewithal to do the heavy targeting, not just the bridges, but Russian military leadership, for example. And so it would be the United States providing geo-coordinates, pattern intelligence. General so-and-so is going to leave his apartment at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, and he's going to go to this building or to that coffee house or whatever, so that the Ukrainians could hit him with a drone, with a close-in assassination. So targeting, number one. Excuse me. And the other thing is training. I remember in the very earliest days of the conflict where Ukrainian pilots were being brought to Texas to train on the, whatever it was, the F-14, the F-16, whatever it was. We hadn't even given them those aircraft yet, but they were training on them so that once Congress got its act together to turn the equipment over to the Ukrainians, they would be ready to go. So sure. And you know, this isn't unique. This is what the Russians and the Chinese did to the United States during the Vietnam War. This is, you know, we fight these proxy wars all the time.
Wow.
Where, you know, instead of letting the diplomats do what they're trained to do and maybe negotiate a peace deal, it's all about just killing.
Let me say this. I am so happy for you. You know, I mean, you've had rough times and you didn't deserve them.
Yeah,
and you fought the good fight and you told the truth and you were unjustly punished, and you've come out of it.
Thank you.
You've come out of the other side, and you're looking good, and you're sounding good, and everybody wants to talk to you. And I'm every time I turn on the TV and I see you, I told my wife, I said, "There's John, man. I'm so proud of him. Go, John, go."
Thank you so much, man.
Keep it up,
man. Thank you so much. Thank God, everything's turned around.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm proud to call you a friend and a colleague.
And same here.
Yeah.
Honored to call you a friend.
I'll be back home in Miami soon, or for winter, of course. It's a little rough here around that time.
And, right. I'm in Miami now. I look forward to seeing you here.
You and I will have an old-fashioned by the pool. I guarantee it. We'll make it happen.
Count me in. Count me in.
John Kariakou. Thanks, my friend. You're the best. See ya.
All the best.
All right. Time for comments now from my conversation over here. With the one I had with Runjun the other day, Runjun Sharma on India. So let's start there. Raghav Kumar says, "Mr. Kumar, excellent perspective, which is objective toward India and Israel. The Islamist and Chinese bots and lobbies are not going to like this." Yeah, you're probably right, they're not. Arshia Sibal says, "I feel so embarrassed listening to this. Israel is a genocidal apartheid state. What a shame." Thank you, Mr. Sibal. But here's how I see it. I disagree. Dialogue between Israel and India is okay. Approval is not. That's different. Tanmay Doc says, "India is the only smart country. It first safeguards its interests. And in fact, every country should think like that." You're absolutely right. And by the way, think about this. It has 1.4 billion reasons to do so. About the Trump visit to China, which we started the discussion about yesterday. Cy Ryder says, "This is going to be the worst presidential state visit of all time. Trump is used to dealing with yes men. His ego collapses when he's in front of a strong personality." Stefan Seen says, "Just curious if it means something that Xi did not meet Mr. Trump at the airport. The Chinese are respectful, yes, as I said yesterday, but they seem to have subtle diplomatic gestures to let you know the level of welcomeness. Love your show. Best from Germany." Yeah, you're right about that, by the way. They're saying something with that. And by the way, Stefan, thank you. It's amazing how many people are able to watch us every day in Germany, despite the fact that we're supposed to be banned there. They still find a way to watch us. Chuffmeister, speaking of Germany, says, "Winning against Iran isn't the objective. Stopping China from getting access to oil anywhere in the world and selling it to anyone else in the world, that's the objective. And this is how WW3, World War III, will begin." Ooh. Thank you, Mr. Chuff. And that's why we do this show, by the way, because we think only through truth can we help to keep something as horrible as what you just said from happening. All right, as usual, all the feedback is appreciated. You can check out my social media. We're on X, we're on Spotify, we're on BitChute, where some big announcements are forthcoming. We're still working on it. Thank you so much for being part of the show. Thank you so much for letting us into your homes. And thanks again to John Kariakou for that wonderful interview he just granted us. See you next time.